Good day, Thomas Jefferson Hour podcast listeners, and welcome to this episode of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Before we begin talking about this episode, I want to thank all of you, and there are a bunch of new ones of you. I welcome you, who have decided to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour by joining the 1776 Club. I want to specifically thank Mr. Avery Champion, who in his letter said, even though I don't have a lot of money, semi-retired, semi-poor old person, a current episode prompted him to look for the podcast and go to the donations page. It is you, sir, and folks like you who keep this program on the air. This is not a for-profit program. There are no salaries involved.
Good. And this week, out of character.
Yes. So just to wrap that up, we do appreciate your support more than you understand, probably. And so we keep hammering that point. If you'd like to support the Thomas Jefferson Hour, go to jeffersonhour.com, and there's all the information there on the donate page, and as well as a lot of other stuff, tons of information there.
So, David, I was just on the annual Lewis and Clark cultural tour in Montana and Idaho, and among other things, people asked after you, as they always do. They said they love the website. They like the 1776 Club. One woman came to me and said that 2 years ago, she got seeds for tomatoes from you.
Oh, really?
And that they thrived.
Oh, great.
And that she so appreciates what you did.
Oh.
By offering, you offered free seeds up to limited number for people who sent you a stamp.
Well, I saved as many as I could that year. And if they sent me a self-addressed stamped envelope, I sent them seeds.
And then
I don't have any more, so don't do that.
At one of our roundtable conversations out in Idaho, I said, all right, how many like the gardening segment and how many say enough already?
Oh, yeah?
And most people said, more gardening, more gardening.
Well, not now.
Anyway. Not now. But this program is out of character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just back from the annual trip.
It starts and ends with the annual trip.
We always
trip,
report
right.
A little bit about that and the kind of people that I meet, most of whom are Jefferson Hour people. But then in the middle, We went back to our new friend, Bo Wright. How old is this Wright? He's in his 30s.
I think so.
Yeah, he's this kid who worked for Obama for 5.5 years. He's got a great sense of humor. And we challenged, he had a conversation a few weeks ago with Thomas Jefferson, and Jefferson challenged him to go to Poplar Forest, Jefferson's retirement home in Lynchburg. I think he lives there. And then also go to the Natural Bridge. And he did both and gave us a splendid report.
Mm-hmm. Along with some insight into his time in the White House. And
he said something that really got into your skin.
It did. At the end of the program, we talked about it again, but early on, he made a comment about, well, you and he were going on about some of the craziness.
It's a crazy time.
We're recording this on a day where there's been yet another
White
House.
There's a new chief of staff. Scaramucci has been fired. We don't know what else has happened in the last 7 minutes.
Be a Trump supporter or not a Trump supporter.
It's chaos time.
You got to admit that this is, it's unprecedented, some of this stuff. But he made this comment about sometimes bureaucracy is a good thing in slowing down.
But there's a continuity.
Right.
There's a public service component. There's something beyond politics.
So it's fair to say that the current president was elected somewhat on the idea that throw the rascals out. Blow it all up, start over again. And a lot of people said, you know what? Yeah, let's do that. But careful what you wish for, because professional politicians know how to accomplish things that the people want accomplished.
And this isn't necessarily even politics. You know, somebody has to administer the National Park Service. Somebody has to do timber permits in the National Forest. Somebody has to do White House tours. Somebody has to make sure you get your Social Security check. Somebody has to fund research and development into cancer and kidney disease. Those things are not done by senators. By the permanent bureaucracy.
That's really not what the show is about, although we did touch on it at the end. And you know, I have a tough time being so cynical thinking that every bureaucrat is sitting around taking advantage and not doing his job. And Bo talked about that, and I thought it was very eloquent.
And it reminded us that, you know, politicians, even presidents, come and go.
Uh-huh.
But there is a government that has continuity,
right.
And it's largely filled with extremely well-meaning, thoughtful people who are trying to do public service for the rest of us. And so that's great. But now listen to this out-of-character program with Bo Wright as the star, but also some talk about the annual Becky drowning incident on the Lewis and Clark Trail. Thanks for listening.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, or perhaps your weekly conversation with the gentleman who created the Thomas Jefferson Hour, the gentleman seated across from me now, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. Good to see you, sir. I can tell you've been outside some.
I have been tanned, and I have been challenged by the annual Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour in Montana and Idaho. I'm just back, David, and there were a couple of dozen people on this year's trip. We had a fabulous time. Most of the people, I would say 95% of all people who come on these trips are Jefferson Hour stalwarts. They come from all over the country. This year we had people from California and from Virginia and from Alabama and Michigan and every part in between. And we had about 10 days in the heart of the Lewis and Clark Trail, first in the White Cliffs section of the Missouri River, by far the most beautiful canoeing section of the entire 2,500-mile Missouri. And then we spent 4 days up on the low trail, precisely in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark. They had to make a transit of the Rocky Mountains. They went through what we call the Bitterroots between early September and early October in 1805. They got waylaid by snow. They were lost. It was a difficult time, almost a starving time for the expedition. And we always go up to be precisely in their footsteps. We go to places like the sinkhole described by the journal keepers, the Lonesome Cove described by journal keeper Joseph Whitehouse, to the smoking place, a sacred Nez Perce smoking site, which Lewis permitted the Nez Perce to convince him to stop at on the return journey. And so this is the trip of trips, and the vast majority of the people who come on them are Jefferson Hour listeners. We love that. They bring a special sort of energy and attitude towards the adventure. But I can tell you this, and you know what I'm about to say. Over and over again, they said, where's this David Swenson? Does he actually exist? Is he a voice-modulated synthesizer of some sort? Why does he never come on any of these journeys? We hear a lot about him, but he seems to be a kind of a shadow figure. Can you confirm his existence?
If I was a voice-modulated, what did you call it?
I don't know, synthesizer.
Yeah, I'd be much better at this if that was the case.
But there really is. I mean, you know this because I say this every time I come back from a trip. People invariably say, tell me more about David Swenson. Why doesn't he ever come with you? I said, we spent a lot of time together. I'm sure he has better things to do. But you're a shy man, and you're kind of a homebody. But
I'm not entirely sure if that's true, but I will say this, that I've made a mistake in constructing my career, many mistakes, but one is that I always seem to be very, very busy in the summertime, and this summer is no exception.
Well, all I'm trying to tell you is that you have enormous goodwill out there, and a lot of people want to know more about you, and a lot of people would like at some point to meet you because they tell me a couple of things. They tell me how much they enjoy you. They like your sensibilities. They like the way you moderate this conversation, and they like...
So why would I want to risk all that by showing up in person?
That's what I say. There's a reason we do radio, folks. You don't ever really want to meet us.
Uh-huh.
So this one of the people who came on the trip was this guy from Baltimore and his daughter from Williamsburg, and they were fantastic, Jim and Liz. And so he said, you know, he's been a fan for many years. He listens to the show, and that when he offered this to her as a graduation gift from William and Mary, he says he actually squealed in delight. And then after about 4 days, they looked at me and said, yeah, now we know why it's better on radio. Yeah, really nice. Really, really nice.
Well, I always enjoy talking about Lewis and Clark with you because hands down, you know more about this than anyone I know.
Oh, I wish that were true, but you know, I'm now...
Well, than anyone I know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know a lot of people. I'll tell you a couple of things. One is that I'm now the editor of We Proceeded On, the quarterly journal of the Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation. I urge everyone to go to their website, so Lewis and Clark Trail Heritage Foundation, and subscribe. My first issue will be out in about 2 weeks. It features an article by someone known to the Jefferson Hour folks, David Nicandry, about Lewis's homesickness during his time at Fort Clatsop in the winter of 1805 and early 1806. And there's also an extended interview, with Dr. Elliot West of the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, he's one of the greatest historians of the American West, maybe the greatest historian of the American West writing today. And I did a long interview with him that was transcribed for the magazine by none other than Russ Eagle of North Carolina. You know of Russ Eagle, of course.
Right. Was Russ on the trip this year?
No, he was not. He said two years ago, I mean, I hate to tell this story, but 2 years ago, Russ set the record for the Wendover March on foot of 3 hours and 1 minute. He calls it 3-0-1. You know, he's a Southerner and he's still learning arithmetic, but 3-0-1. And he set the record. And then he got kind of, you know how people retire at the top of their game? So he said he wasn't coming back, especially the next year. Mike Harry of Nashville, actually Franklin, the site of the, quote, last great battle of the Civil War. Mike Harry ran up and he defeated everyone, and he even humbled the famous Chad, who's our favorite guide and mountain man and Olympic athlete out there. So Chad is like the gold standard of this mountain. And Mike Harry essentially ran at full speed up the mountain, and he humbled Chad, and he destroyed Russ Eagle. So Russ did not come back this year. I'm sure he's licking his wounds somewhere, but he plans to come back next year.
People who have listened to the show know a lot about this. You've done it for...
Well, this is my 12th time up the Wendover March.
We get these images of you floating down the river in canoes and the wonderful scenery.
Sometimes in canoes. There's the Becky factor.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wanted to get to that. Also, you are well taken care of. You have
great outfitter, Wayne Fairchild, Lewis and Clark Trail Adventures
and
out of Missoula. Fantastic.
Great food, from what I understand.
Excellent food, good drink.
On a more serious note, you do spend time talking about Lewis and Clark, do you not?
The first night, we go to the actual Great Falls, just west of...
Which is just so sad to see.
Yeah, but it's not as bad as, say, Garrison Dam or...
I don't know. I went through there last year, and can you explain what's happened to
it? Well, back in the 1920s, I think a dam was put up there, and they do have a spillway, and they've tried to preserve some sense of what the Great Falls must have looked like. After all, remember, David Lewis said it was second only to Niagara and maybe greater.
Yeah.
And once the people with concrete get at any great wonder in the American West,
well, there's a series
it.
Of dams.
There are
now,
five falls there. There are five cataracts, and there are a series of dams, and this one is Ryan Dam, and it's not ugly, but it certainly doesn't preserve the sublimity that Lewis found there on June 13th, 1805.
Yeah, parts of it are quite industrial.
So we go there the first night, and I actually perform as Meriwether Lewis the first night, complete in buckskins. And then the next day we get on the river, and for 3 days, it's really a kind of idyllic, almost paradise on earth, 85 degrees by day, 60 or so by night. Better stars than you've ever seen in your entire life because there are no competing lights. Often enough, a thunderstorm. We see bald eagles. We see golden eagles. We occasionally see a bighorn sheep. No buffalo, unfortunately. We see plenty of Angus. But that's the biggest single change. Deer, pronghorn antelope, prairie dogs. And while we go down the river, David, it's still something of an actual river there. It doesn't stay that way once it reaches the Montana border, the Montana-North Dakota border. But out there west of Great Falls in what's known as the White Cliffs section of the Missouri, the river is about as beautiful as it ever can be in the 21st century. And we spent 3 days floating along it. The river does most of the work. It's really unbelievable. And when you get to camp at the end of the day, you know, you're just a tiny bit fatigued, but not badly. And then there are hors d'oeuvres and beer and wine waiting, and later a sit-down dinner with tablecloths and salads and on actual china plates. And it's a pretty amazing thing. And then I talk around the campfire about some aspect of Lewis and Clark or Jefferson or the American West every night.
We need to get to the big question.
The elephant in the river.
Becky did not drown you because you're here.
She tried.
Will you be buying a new camera?
No. For the
really?
I did not go in the river, not at least overboard. We swam often, and on the last day, we bobbed down the river to camp, which is just an amazing thing. In a life jacket, just letting the river do the work, you feel like Huck Finn better. You feel like you're letting one of the world's great rivers buoy you and carry you down to camp. It's really about as extraordinary an experience as you can have. And, you know, you wouldn't try it in the James. You wouldn't try it in the Potomac. You wouldn't try it in the Mississippi.
I doubt anyone from the expedition did this.
No.
Yeah.
They were not water. Many of them couldn't swim. You know, maybe five or six couldn't swim, we learn at one point or another. But anyway, so Becky, my canoe partner and my dear friend, has tried, as you know, from time to time to drown me. I've bought many cameras. I've left many cameras at the bottom of the river. I've left full libraries of Lewis and Clark books and all of my dignity. And so everyone comes on this trip thinking that I'm some kind of a whining, complaining, narcissistic person.
Oh, not you, no.
Who likes, you know, that Becky, that I make all this up about Becky. And I give this little orientation lecture on the first day, and I say, there's only one rule besides no whining, and that is do not stand up in the canoe. Do not stand up in the canoe. A canoe is a very stable device.
If you're seated.
If you stay seated, if you keep your center. And so we get in, you know, after all this, we get in and Becky's in front and I'm in back. And we go out into the river. And no matter if it's 40 degrees when we start or 87 degrees when we start, we get about 100 yards and she says, oh, I didn't put on any sunscreen. I probably better do that. Or wonder where my lip gloss is. Or I thought I'd take some pictures. Is that camera back there somewhere? Okay, so I'll just say this, David. Okay, she didn't drown me, and I know you're a little skeptical. So I urge you. I'll give you the roster. Call up anyone you want. Ask them for the truth. They'll tell you. But look, it's good news. Nobody went in the drink. No camera was destroyed. She made no overt attempt to kill me this year, and we came out unscathed. And so what more could anyone want?
We need to take a short break, but we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, or your weekly conversation with the gentleman who created the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Mr. Clay Jenkinson, the gentleman seated across from me now, the gentleman who survived one more year on the Lewis and Clark trip.
You know, every year, it's kind of a same time next year sort of thing, David. You go out and you test your soul, you test your heart, you test your body, you meet new friends, you meet old friends. It's an amazing journey, and I urge people to think about it. And the next ones are the two winter encampments
right. At
Locksaw Lodge in January, one on Walden and Desert Solitaire by Edward Abbey.
And Shakespeare, right?
And the second one on Shakespeare. And then I should say, on the 22nd of September, I hope Bo will come, on the 22nd of September in Norfolk, I'm doing the first ever of my new Shakespeare thing. I'm doing an evening about Shakespeare, which was my first love back in my salad days. And I'm doing a two-hour evening about William Shakespeare at the Roper Theater in Norfolk, Virginia. And I want everyone who's listening to consider coming. I'm going to be doing this all over the country. This is something I'm undertaking now. As you probably know, my lifelong dream was to play Hamlet. I've kind of entered the King Lear phase of my biology. But I'm going to work with my friend Paul Lasico. It's going to be a fabulous evening, not at all literary. It's going to be fun, commentary, joy, humor, but some real Shakespeare. And Paul is going to portray in the last scene the gravedigger from the famous graveyard scene in Hamlet, and I'll be portraying Hamlet for at least those 6 minutes. So the 22nd of September, the Roper Theater in Norfolk. And then in March, Steinbeck 2. We're doing our second annual Steinbeck's California trip.
Oh, great. Yeah, that went really well last year, right?
It was great. It was a wonderful trip. So all that's yet to come. They can go to the website, of course, and find out all the details.
Well, back to the beginning of our conversation, we were talking about this trip and between all of the enjoyment that you described and the great food and
the stars, the
threats
and the
on your
coyotes.
Life, you know, like, to be serious, I mean, for me, what really attracts me to these places is the historical context of them, to be able to go there and see where these, I mean, I remember as a 19-year-old going to Georgetown for one of the first times and walking the streets there, and the historical context of these places. And you mentioned Beau. You hoped Beau would come to see you in Norfolk.
People now know the famous Beau Wright, formerly of the Obama administration, now unemployed. No, wait. he's now the director of operations.
Be careful what you say. We have Beau on the line.
Yeah, for United to Protect Democracy. And he was on. We got a lot of great feedback from the Beau segment. And so I challenged him to go to the Natural Bridge and Poplar Forest. And apparently, unlike Becky, he did.
Beau, say hello, please.
Hi, everybody.
and we really did get great compliments on your show. For those who haven't heard it, Beau spoke to President Jefferson, and they compared notes about the White House during Jefferson's time and during your time, Beau. And I sat back and really enjoyed that conversation very much, especially when Jefferson became just befuddled about some of the modern things that you talked about.
I know. I think we gave him some kind of a hard time.
It was a great conversation. And of course, so you have a kind of triple contrast here, Beau. You have Thomas Jefferson, the third president of the United States, who was essentially a staff of one. Then you have Barack Obama, the first African-American president, and you served under him and did distinguished work for President Obama. And now we have, whatever your politics, what must be seen as the craziest presidency in American history. Imagine for a moment if you were in your present position in the Trump White House.
It's unfathomable. A number of my colleagues at the White House were career civil servants who are there. They're called historically retained positions, and they'll stay no matter who is president. Oftentimes, everybody there serves at the pleasure of the president, but they're generally acting in an apolitical capacity, so they tend to stay. So I know that the White House, outside of the sort of political aspects of the institution, is still being well served by really incredible public servants who have come to work there in some cases for 20, 30 years. So if I were there now, I know I would still feel in safe hands because I'd be working with them.
So this is the deep state we keep hearing about, these permanent people who are preventing the revolution that Trump is trying to bring for the American people. Is that what you're saying?
Look, I'm not, the bureaucracy can actually serve a really valuable purpose. I think that they are sometimes, our civil servants are unfairly maligned at times.
You know, you have a unique position here, and I know we're not trying to get into a discussion of the Trump administration, but every president has chaos in their administration. This can't be helped. Lots of egos, lots of ambition, lots of overlapping responsibilities, mixed signals, sudden events that creep up from Korea or the Middle East or Katrina here or a tornado there. There's a certain kind of wonderful chaos to being at the center of any great administration. But as you look at it from the outside and watch what's unfolding here, Beau, you must just either laugh or shake your head or weep for America.
Weep, I think, or laugh to keep from crying, one or the other. I once heard President Obama say in response to a question about in 20 years' time, what would he be most proud of about his administration? And the president's answer had nothing to do with policy, in fact, although I suppose in a tangential way it did. He said, I'm proud of my staffing. And I think that in 20 years' time, I hope that historians will note that I gathered around me people, especially at the sort of upper echelons, who were competent and capable and steady hands. Because it's in America's interest for the government to be stable and in good hands and for thoughtful policy to be able to be made. Again, that's indiscriminate. I think most people, indiscriminate politics, I think most people would think that, or would say that James Baker was the best chief of staff of all time, and that was in a Republican administration.
Fair enough. Let's turn to more agreeable topics, but I wanted to at least hear a little bit from you because I know you've been inside the penultimate administration. When you were on the show, I challenged you, I think, to go to Poplar Forest, Jefferson's second home, his octagonal home in your part of the world, and also to go to the Natural Bridge and to try, as a liberal, to throw a coin across that river. How'd that work out?
I almost made it. Both went really well. Poplar Forest is in excellent shape, and it's really, I think, becoming a really, I'm kind of a booster for the region anyhow, but it's becoming a real attraction here in Central Virginia. And it's not only on the register of national landmarks, but it's just an exquisite piece of architecture, one of the first octagonal homes in the country, if not the first.
Before you go any farther, for new listeners or people who aren't aware of Poplar Forest, Clay, can you share why it's so significant for Jefferson?
Well, I'll start, and Beau can pick it up, but Jefferson built Monticello. It was never really finished. The press of visitors and travelers through his part of Virginia at Charlottesville was huge. In some sense, he was almost being eaten out of house and home. He had a number of plantations, and his most productive and successful ones were actually ones that he inherited via his wife from John Wales, and these were the Bedford or the Lynchburg plantations, including Poplar Forest, and Jefferson felt the need to go there once or twice or three times per year just to check on his overseers and see what was happening at Poplar Forest, and he would stay in a hut or with an overseer. And finally, he thought, you know, I'll build myself a nice, modest little place there. So
yeah,
that when
right.
I go, I'll have a. Then the Jeffersonian imagination took hold of him. So, but when you go there, what do you see?
So you see the home, obviously, and I think the original estate was around 4,800 acres all told, and now it's down to about 600 acres. Though when it was sold to the foundation that runs it now in the 1980s. It was just the home on a plot of 50 acres. So today you see the home and the surrounding grounds, including the gardens. They have been, as I mentioned on the previous show, they have really painstakingly restored it with a real eye towards authenticity. So they're working especially with scholars from Colonial Williamsburg to redo the house as Jefferson intended and as he lived in it.
Right, and so it's not the little modest shack that he intended, is it?
Oh, forgive me. No, it's this beautiful Palladio-inspired home I was reading the materials, and they emphasized that Jefferson really applied a lot of his mathematical expertise in the designing of this home. And that had he not been so adept at mathematics, it would have been a real challenge to design something this exquisite and perfect in a lot of ways.
The restoration is just world class. The woodwork is spectacular. You just sit and stare at it with admiration, not only for Jefferson but for the authentic workmanship that's being done on the home. And then it has this splendid grounds, an octagonal privy. The wings that go out from each side, they've done a lot of restoration there. When you went into it, my favorite room in the entire complex is the central dining room, which is this perfect cube. Are the walls plastered now? What's the status of the dining room?
The dining room is in excellent shape, but Jefferson intended for the building to look as though it were one story when you approach the house, and then you come into the dining room, and it it's a dramatic 20 by 20 by 20 foot room. And so you look up and there's this big skylight and it just opens above you. It's a really dramatic room to enter. It's really exceptional. So come on down and see
us. So I will. We will. I've been saying to David Swenson, we have to get him out of this barn at some point. But, but you know, I often sit in that room, the dining room, 20 by 20 by 20. No windows except this extraordinary and intricate skylight that Jefferson fashioned above it. If you think about the Enlightenment with its interest in rectilinearity and order and squares, straight lines and so on, there probably is no room in the world that is quite like the dining room at Poplar Forest. You just get a sense of Jefferson sitting there in one of his famous chairs with a small library that he had at Poplar Forest, reading and feeling more rational just for sitting in such a space. So you went to Poplar Forest and you had a great tour. How many people were there on the day you were there?
I went to see a play. So in addition to hosting tours of the home, and they also have architectural digs on the site, they also opened it up as a venue for public events. In this case, it was the staging of the complete history of America abridged. And so, you know, they're talking about Thomas Jefferson, who's one of the characters in the play, in front of his home. So there are several hundred of us out there on a balmy Southern Virginia evening, cold wine in hand, white wine in hand. It was pretty magical.
Fantastic. Let me just remind, I wish I'd been there. I wish David and I had been there with a bottle of Bordeaux, not the kind of swill that you buy in Virginia. But
hey,
let me just say that Bo Wright is the director of operations.
That wasn't really called for.
For United to Protect Democracy, previously served in President Obama's White House for 5.5 years, most recently as senior deputy director of operations and director for finance. Bo, then we could go on and on about Poplar Forest, but I do urge people to go to it.
Well, one more thing about Poplar Forest. It's just the perspective of it. We probably take this for granted because we know, but this was really his retreat in a lot of ways. I mean, I've read stories about time he would spend with his children.
He would take grandchildren.
Yeah, and it was a really happy time. And you mentioned earlier, he was being eaten out of house and home. And I don't know if people understand that sort of
Virginia hospitality.
Right.
And once Martha, his daughter, said
people would come and stay for
50 overnight guests, she said. You know, they had to find stables for the horses and hay and fodder and oats for them and feed people and house people.
You couldn't say no.
No, and Jefferson wasn't the kind of person who could say no. And so he would like to get away. And it's so beautiful. He would take a couple of his granddaughters, mm-hmm. and they would just vie for this position. They wanted their grandfather
because they adored him.
And they got him alone. You know, otherwise he's a public figure, and they adored him. And then he would go with them, and they would have these kind of zany journeys, which were a little uncomfortable. It's like staying in a Motel 6 that's been recently condemned. But they would get there, and then they would have a month or 6 weeks with Grandpapa.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there would be slaves and servants around, but it's essentially exclusive time with this remarkable Renaissance
See, I
man.
Think that's really significant. And didn't he send his family there to protect them, too?
Well, he sent them to Bedford before he built the place. But,
uh-huh.
but when the war came to Virginia in 1781, they left Monticello and went to Carter's Mountain. And then when things got a little less chaotic, they went down to Bedford
mm-hmm.
and presumably stayed in an overseer's
Well, I guess my point is that it really was an important part of
It was
his,
a retreat for him, and it was a chance for him. Monticello was a semi-public place, but Poplar Forest was just an idea with a capital I. I'm going to do everything in octagons. I don't have to please anybody. It's really for myself. It's kind of a laboratory of Enlightenment architecture. So I love it there, and I'd love to see a play there. Bo, then you went on to another place in that district, the famous Natural Bridge, now owned by the state of Virginia.
Yes, so it's managed by the by our Department of Natural Resources, and it previously had been in private hands, and so we hopped in the car and drove over to Rockbridge County, which is not far away, to see the bridge, which was also owned by Mr. Jefferson for a time, and it's a stunning limestone monolith that is the remnant of what they think to be. It's all hypothesis, but they believe it's what's left of the roof of a cave through which a subterranean river flowed, that then the rest of it collapsed, but this bridge remains. And so it soars about 215 feet over the sort of pedestrian walkway underneath. It was an ancient site and a sacred one for the Monacan Indians for presumably many centuries. And then it really entered, I think, the national consciousness in the late 18th century, early 19th century.
Now, Jefferson, when he was there, fell in love with it and purchased it to prevent it being adversely exploited in some way or other. He's in a certain sense the father of the national park system in that private purchase. But he wrote a famous passage in his only book, Notes on Virginia, about this. When you were there, did you get a violent headache?
Practically, I had to throw myself down on hands and knees.
You were on hands and knees. You got a violent headache. And the feelings of the sublime, I take it, could not be improved upon.
No, sir, not at all.
So, and did you follow my advice and attempt to throw a silver dollar or anything of equal mass across the river?
I did.
What happened? You were arrested for pollution.
That's right, for littering.
Did the coin cross the river?
Yes. Though I have to confess, the creek is actually not quite far. I think George Washington apocryphally threw a coin over the natural bridge.
Is there video?
I'll ask my companion if she took any.
I want to know we need to meet your companion to verify some of these stories. But so there is no video of the coin toss.
There is no video. Unless it was surreptitious.
Bo, stick around. We'll talk for a couple of minutes on the other side, but let me remind everyone, this is a special edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. We're talking with the now famous coin tosser, Bo Wright, now Director of Operations for United to Protect Democracy, formerly a Senior Deputy Director of Operations and Director for Finance for none other than President Barack Obama. We'll take a short break. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. And welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This is Clay Jenkins, and out of character this week, David Swenson is sitting across from me. And on the phone from Virginia is Mr. Bo Wright, who at our request, I think at Mr. Jefferson's request.
Yeah, David, I think it was more than a request. Well, actually, it was Jefferson giving him the orders, wasn't it?
He just said that he would appreciate an on-the-scene report.
And
Bo went to Poplar Forest, Jefferson's retirement home in Bedford in Lynchburg, which is now a 600-acre magnificent historical site.
And thank you for that, Bo.
And then to the Natural Bridge, which is more whimsical. But, Bo, when I've been to the Natural Bridge 15 or 20 times. In private hands, it was a little on the, how should I put it, kitschy, cheesy side. Colored lights, patriotic and religious ceremonies and music and a giant swing and an old hotel and blah, blah, blah. I take it the state is probably moving carefully, but attempting to restore something of the authenticity of the place.
Yeah, that's right. So there was an associated site up until the state took over nearby called Foamhenge.
Foamhenge, yes.
Which has now been relocated to Northern Virginia because the the state didn't feel like it really had much relevance to the natural bridge, I think wisely.
So Foamhenge was what? A Stonehenge-like henge structure?
That's exact. Yeah, it's an exact replica of Stonehenge, but out of foam.
So Foamhenge is gone. What else are they doing to de-louse the site?
Well, so there are no longer the sort of light shows, though they, at least not on the public's time or using public expense. I think they do have some shows after hours. The Wax Museum, which was right nearby, has closed. And I think they're really trying to restore its authenticity and focus on scholarship as opposed to perhaps legend of the site that might not be really be based in fact. So, for example, previously you might have been told that George Washington surveyed the site and that he threw a coin over the bridge and that should be taken as fact. When it is at best apocryphal.
You know, this is what we hated about Obama, beating up on American. What are you saying to us, that the coin thing didn't happen? Is this some sort of liberal revisionism? Come on, are you saying that there's no historical basis for the legend that Washington tossed a coin over the thing?
I'm saying it hasn't been verified. Yeah. By scholars independently.
Well, that's the last trip we send you on. All right, but go ahead. So
wait, this guy's doing it. Be nice.
So when you were there, tell us honestly. You know, Jefferson thought it was worth a trip across the Atlantic to see this thing. He invited Mrs. Cosway to come from Paris or London to paint the Natural Bridge. He's, as I said, in a sense, the father of the national park system with that purchase. What is the actual feeling of being there if you don't go with Jeffersonian expectation?
I still think it's an incredibly impressive site. And I'm a Virginian and a proud one at that. So I think I'm likely to suggest that anyone should visit it. Is it as dramatic? If you didn't have the Grand Canyon to compare it to, which Jefferson did not, or other architectural wonders. I think a lot of folks in the early 19th century compared it with Niagara Falls in terms of grandeur.
Did you or did you not have a violent headache?
Turns out I don't really get headaches.
You should, again, for listeners who are new or don't know, share that story.
In this famous passage, Jefferson says that, you know, from below, the feelings of the sublime could not be improved upon. But he said, if you get up on it and peer over the side, you have to get down on your hands and knees to do it. And he said, being there for like half a minute gave me, quote, a violent headache. And so partly Jefferson is participating in the whole literary tradition of the sublime that goes back to Edmund Burke and beyond. But partly, Jefferson is the kind of person who might have a headache on top of it. I don't know, Bo. I've never been. There's a road over it now. I hope they eventually can relocate that. But I imagine in Jefferson's time, being on top of that thing might have been a little scary.
I think it would have been startling, but it does seem somewhat hyperbolic. And I also was surprised to learn that State Route 11 does pass right over the bridge, though they have since in the past couple decades they've secured it the arch itself so that hopefully the vibrations from the road don't actually cause real damage.
Well, in the long run, it would be great to relocate that road altogether and make it a picnic spot or whatever. It's, you know, you walk down, you go through this large building to get to the path, and then you walk down, and it's a wonderful walk. I've been there in every season, and you see this somewhat modest little river coming through, and then when you eventually turn a corner, and there it is. And, you know, if you've been to Arches National Park or Canyonlands or Bryce or Zion or any of those, you go in with a kind of skepticism. But when you turn that corner, it is pretty amazing, isn't it?
It really is. I think it's a In a way, it was something that we went to as school kids on field trips, but it's not. I don't think it carries the same kind of name recognition nationally as it used to.
Well, if visitation skyrockets now, it'll be on your shoulders. But what can we challenge you to do next? I mean, what would you like to see as a roving reporter for the Thomas Jefferson Hour within something like striking range of where you live?
Oh, that's such a great question. May I get back to you? I'd like to look into that, and if you'll have me, I would love to do some more on the scene reporting.
Well, yes, I think one thing, and I don't know, you know, how much time you have on your hands. I know you're very busy with your new work, but something that would be fun for you to do for us would be to go to Hohenwald in Tennessee, which is not very far, and to see the gravesite of Captain Meriwether Lewis, who is of special interest to Jefferson and to David Swenson and me. So that would be a trip on, out on the Natchez Trace. And, you know, I'm thinking maybe Paris, London. I don't know what your schedule is.
Yeah, and he'll talk to you about a travel budget after the show.
Yeah. I'll share our travel budget with you.
We really did get some nice comments on your past appearance. One in particular from a gentleman named Avery Champion, who said, I'm listening to that fabulous show with Mr. Bo Wright. Mr. Wright's insights and anecdotes were so very interesting in the discussion between President Jefferson and Mr. Wright.
You are very kind to have me, and you were very kind to share that note with me. And I think one thing that he says at the end, which is really quite true, is just what a real public service the Thomas Jefferson Hour is for those of us who listen to it. So I think that's
spread the good news. And
I really think what we need Mr. Wright to do is find some hardcore left and right politicians who could maybe have a question or two for Thomas Jefferson and learn how to deal with one another properly.
I can do better than that. I'll play the Wizard of Oz. Come back when you've got Obama on the air. What's wrong with him? Hanging out in Hawaii, going to Scotland to golf at St. Andrews. Can't he give us 15 minutes? He's your pal.
I'll ask him.
Yeah, you're stammering now. So do you or do you not have actual acquaintances/friends that are inside the current White House?
You know, as it happens, I actually do. I have a number of
So
friends.
Here's what I would suggest. I want to get serious for a moment. I think you should talk with a couple of them, tell them that you're now a correspondent on the Jefferson Hour, tell them that obviously you don't wish them to be leakers, but to get a sense, I mean, an actual sense, a historical sense of what's it like to be there, what's the thrill, the sense of honor, the awe, what's the craziness, but to sort of talk with them and say, not about politics, not about Trump, not about anything, but what's it like to be in this administration, deep inside the White House, trying to do good things on behalf of the American people, and bring back insights that are not partisan insights, but are insights about the nature of the center of power in the free world.
That I can do.
That would be fantastic. And we'll keep it strictly nonpartisan because what we want to do here is to really understand. So Jefferson and Lewis lived essentially alone in the White House, and he wrote a famous letter to his daughter Martha saying we're like two church mice in this building. Today it's a much, much different sort of place, and there's nothing like the beginning of an administration to create a sense of possibility, awe, and I suppose you'd say anxiety about how do you sit at the center of power in a world as amazing but also as dangerous as the one that we now live in. And so if you could do that, I think you should take a look at a map. You're too young to realize there used to be maps, but you could buy a map of the Appalachian world and see places that you might want to visit. But as often as you want to come on as our reporter.
We'd love to have you. But I want to go back to something that you said earlier, Bo, that really stuck with me. And you said that bureaucracy can be a good thing.
Yes. So on the last time you all were kind enough to have me on, we talked about the several million current federal employees. And I think it's so easy that for us to take our federal civil workforce for granted. And a lot of them are so civic-minded and well-intentioned, which is not to say that that folks shouldn't expect government to work well. You know, when they interact with a government agency, it should be a seamless process. And there are plenty of folks in government who spend every day thinking about how to make the government more accessible, more functional, and responsive to people. But there's not a single federal employee that I worked with at the White House that I didn't think respected their institutions and didn't come to work every day excited, really. And I don't say this in sort of a Pollyanna way. I really believe it. I think that they really came to work every day trying to do the best they could for the American people.
Well, that's a good positive note to end this conversation on.
But I'm just looking back at Bo's biography. it's a sterling biography. He's a very young man. He's got an enormous future ahead of him, probably not as a roving reporter for an obscure public radio.
Well, we can hang on to him for a while.
This is like maybe a gateway drug for him. But but it does say here, Bo, that you were an advanced staff member for that other crazy Vice President Joe Biden. That had to be fun.
Oh, it was great. I got to travel around. I did a handful of domestic trips for the vice president. And he is he's the best, probably the best interpersonal politician I've ever seen, a retail politician. And who he is and, you know, behind the scenes is exactly who he is on stage. He's a real deal.
I met him once, David. I did a program in Pennsylvania for a Democratic Senate retreat, and Biden was there, and he listened to me for 2 hours, and he came up and said, "God, Jefferson sounds a lot like Pat Buchanan." He said, "You know, all that libertarian stuff and limited government and militia only." He said, "That's not the modern Democratic Party. That's some other Democratic Party." Bo Wright, it is a pleasure to have you on. We're going to send you on more trips of this sort. You've brought back a splendid report. We hope you'll send photographs and video of your most recent journey. And when you are ready, just contact us, and we will get you back on for your third report from the inside.
That sounds good. Thank you, gentlemen.
Have a great day, sir.
We've been speaking with Bo Wright, a Virginian, our new Jefferson Hour correspondent. We can't thank you enough, sir, for your time and your contributions to this program, truly. But now, sir, it is time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
On the first day of the annual Lewis and Clark Cultural Tour, David, to Great Falls, Montana, we go around and introduce ourselves, where we're from, what we do, what brought us to this adventure. A few people just turn up somehow, but almost everyone else arrives by way of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Probably they come to watch Becky drown me, or more likely to prove for themselves that reports of my annual near death by drowning have about the same status as barn sightings in western North Dakota. It's always gratifying and moving and humbling to meet people who have made it a weekly habit to listen to this broadcast. Everywhere I go, I have lovely encounters with our listeners. A man on this trip, just now completed, said he had been listening to me for more than 10 years, that I brought clarity, civility, and joy to his life, and he brought his whippersnapper daughter on the trip as a William & Mary graduation gift. I gave my usual response, dream higher. But I was deeply moved. At least twice a year, I meet someone who actually drives to a ridge somewhere to hear the program because the NPR signal is not good enough at his or her house. A wonderful woman in Norfolk waited for over an hour last year in a receiving line to tell me that the Thomas Jefferson Hour had been the factor that led her to reject a mere domestic status and return to higher education to get not one, but by now several degrees. On my car at Loxa Lodge the other day, the last day of our annual trip, someone left a note on my windshield that seemed to say, "You are a national treasure." It was unsigned, and the handwriting was not great, so it might have read, "You are nothing but treacle," or possibly, "You have committed treason," or possibly even, "Your left front tire is flat." When people say generous things, I invariably respond with something that I call bluster, a kind of blushing batting away of the praise. I do this because I am naturally shy. I do this because I regard myself as a radical underachiever, and so I merely want to flagellate myself back to my desk to really master Jefferson this time. I do this because so much of the success of the Jefferson Hour has to do with David Swenson, as host, moderator, friend, and the audience's inside advocate, not to mention the one who edits out some of the verbal slippage. I do this also because whatever is excellent in the Jefferson Hour sits on the shoulders of one of the most remarkable men who ever lived. Yes, he is indeed a paradox, in ways that John Bowles has not plumbed, in ways that the late Alf Mapp Jr. was unable to fathom, in ways that even Joseph Ellis and Merrill Peterson could not penetrate. But Jefferson's easily the most interesting of the Founding Fathers and the one you have to try to come to terms with if you want to understand American history. Both our glorious aspirations in pursuit of unprecedented happiness and our ignominious failure to live up to our unambiguously stated national ideals. My point is this, that we have in the last 20 years created on the Jefferson Hour a community of people who want to live in a more Jeffersonian world. The people I meet in my travels are grammatical, civil, thoughtful, and curious. They read books for pleasure, and not books necessarily with titles like C is for Crime Wave. They agree with Jefferson, at least up to a point, that reason must be our only oracle, and they believe that we are better off listening to science than holding up a snowball on the Senate floor to call global climate change a hoax. They want America to live up to its ideals. They believe we should be a soft power template for the world without ever assuming that everyone else wants to be just like us. They love peace and tolerance and respect. They do not call names. They thrive in thoughtful argument and mutually respectful conversation. They have moral courage, but they try never to be strident. They love nature and nature's law. They are optimists, and they believe that we can make the world a better place for all of its people, not just those of us with a three-car garage or LASIK surgery for our dogs. To meet these people is to cheer up about America. I come away from the annual Lewis and Clark trip recharged, and it really has sent me back to my books to master, or remaster, or new master, that enigmatic genius, Thomas Jefferson. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.